Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is our friend David Bell, with whom we've done many events, and his brand new book, The Finalists, a book that he's only just received himself. You have your own copy, right, David?
They just came this week. I just finally got my hand. You probably had one before I had one, but yes, I just finally got it.
Well, mine's a paper one. Do you remember what's in it?
In the book? Yes, vaguely.
That's what I thought.
The questions will jar my memory and I'll remember the person who wrote that book, yes.
I asked that because what I don't think that fans understand is when we do an event, the author has probably turned in the book over a year ago, has immersed himself in yet another book and might even be into a book after that. And so it's very difficult for them to have complete recall, which is part of my function, because theoretically I've just read it. The other author joining us this evening is Joshua Mulling, and this is his debut, And There He Kept Her. So there are some parallels in the books, which I think will be interesting to discuss. And I want to say, I'm giving a disclaimer before we start. We are in the middle of a monsoon here in Scottsdale, and at any moment we could lose power and disappear. So if we do, I want you to understand that it's the weather. It's not me bored with the author or either the author pulling the plug because they're unhappy with how it's going. It's just one of those things. And if it happens really early, we'll reschedule. And if we get enough in, we won't. So here we are. David, since why don't we do this alphabetically? The finalists. I have to say, David, that reading your book made me rejoice that many years ago I made a decision not to stay in academia. Honestly, It's a snake pit the way you describe it. And you are still in academia. So how do you survive?
Well, academia is a strange place. I tell people that I work in two strange businesses, academia and publishing, neither one of which makes any sense to people in the outside world. I survive because at this point I'm a full professor. And so I have a fair amount of autonomy. The book, The Finalists, is definitely meant to show the financial pressures that are on the institutions and the people who work at the institutions, and then also the students. Everybody is consumed by these financial pressures. And when you work in academia, probably at most schools, maybe not the wealthiest schools, but at most schools, you're always thinking about money and retaining and getting another tuition check or another donor to donate a little bit of money. And that's really what the book is about.
Not any different than running a bookstore. It's hardly
maybe not as fun. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, there is that aspect of it. But the other aspects are that, you know, in our siloed society, people respond to violently, to exuberantly, to various pressures or various causes. You know, there are microaggressions, there are major aggressions, there are, you know, camps all over the place. And somehow or other, we seem to have forgotten good manners and restraint. And I think that our political life is so just horrendous that I think it's carried over into campuses. And so that's a little bit of what we're talking about. And Joshua, let's talk about yours, because you're in a small town where bad things are happening, but it doesn't actually seem to be quite as dangerous as the campus in Davidsburg.
Yeah. I set this book in a small town. I'm really kind of drawn to small towns because they're great settings for people with secrets. And I think there's something about living in a small town that makes people, kind of predisposes people to keep the secrets in the interest of keeping the peace and keeping harmony in the small town.
So we're in Sandy Lake, Minnesota. Most of what I know about small town Minnesota, I've learned from reading William Kent Kruger, who has many of his books involve small Minnesota towns. John Sanford, not so much. Actually, there was like an entire colony of writers in the Twin Cities. Remember, David, how many writers do we know, if you think about it, who live in St. Paul and Minneapolis or hang out there? That's a lot.
Are you counting Prince and Bob Dylan? They're both from Minnesota.
No, I really wasn't. I was just thinking about Minnesota. Crime writers. I mean, they just have, there are cities, Boston, Minnesota, the Twin Cities, LA, New York, and, you know, some degree, maybe San Francisco and Seattle seem to have a disproportionate number of writers compared to, let's say, Phoenix, where there are very few, although very, very successful ones. I don't know why that happens, you know.
Yeah, in Minnesota, you've got John Sanford. He doesn't live in Minnesota anymore, but John Sanford started here. William King Krueger, Brian Freeman, Ellen Hart, Mindy Meja, a lot of crime and thriller writers call this area home.
So, you know, I guess the question is, do you support each other? I mean, if there are a lot of you in one place, you know, does that foster more writing and more creativity, or are writers just as siloed as everybody else these days?
I think so. I've been to plenty of William Ken Kruger's readings. I've read a lot of his books. I've read almost all of John Sanford's books. They don't know me. I'm the new guy in town. It's my very first book, but I think there is a good writing community here in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota in general.
David, do you teach writing at the university, or what's your specialty?
Yeah, I teach creative writing. It's helpful to me just because I feel like at least when I'm at my day job, I'm doing something related to my passion, which is writing. And now that I've been in the business for a while, I have some experience to share with the students. So it keeps my mind thinking about writing all the time.
So why don't I ask you each to do your little elevator pitch for your book, and then perhaps you can ask each other questions. Joshua, you want to go first?
Yeah, so And There He Kept Her opens with two teenagers who break into an old man's house looking for prescription drugs. He's been hit a couple of times. He's known to have these drugs, and so this is the second or third time he's been hit, not necessarily by these same kids. They expect him just to be an old man. They expect him to be asleep, but he catches them in the act. And at the end of kind of the explosive first chapter, one of them is dead and the other is locked up in a kind of like a cage or a room he's got built out in the basement. What these kids don't know is that this old man, his name is Emmett Burr. He was responsible for kidnapping and disappearance of several women years ago. It's been almost two decades since he was active. And now he's an old man. He's isolated. He's borderline living in poverty, and he's dealing with chronic pain. And he ends up with this teenage girl locked in his basement. And he's got to, it's all about how far is he willing to go to protect himself and his secrets. And the looking for these teenagers is Deputy Ben Packard. He's new in town. He's actually related to the girl who is in Emmett's basement. And I think the thing that makes Packard unique, probably in this genre, is that he is a gay man living in a small town, and he's a gay police officer in a small town. And I haven't seen a lot of that in all the books I've read in the current marketplace.
So how safe does he feel as a gay man in a small town? Is it safer than a larger, like an urban area? Or, you know, does everybody just sort of gloss over it?
I think he's still trying to figure that out. That's part of what he's coming to terms with in this book. He thinks he's got a secret that most people don't know that he's gay, but as the book goes along, it becomes more evident that it's not as big of a secret as he thought it was. People talk in a small town, and even when you don't answer their questions, they draw their own conclusions. So I think a lot of this book and the next ones will be more about him trying to be himself in this setting.
Well, let's come back to his personal life, and also be interesting for David to talk to you about your journey to getting published. But anyway, David, what do you remember of the finalists?
So the finalist is the story of a guy named Troy Gaines, and he is the vice president of development at a small private college in Kentucky, a fictional college named Hyde College. And Hyde College is basically propped up by one wealthy family that founded the college back during the 19th century. And every year, this family, the Hyde family, gives this lucrative scholarship to a rising senior. They pick six juniors and they put them in a house on the edge of campus and lock them in for 8 hours. And the students have to take an exam, and they have to take the exam with the current heir to the Hyde fortune. And this year, it's the first year that this heir to the fortune is administering the exam. So they get locked in the room on the edge of campus. There's a protest going on outside because the Hyde family has been involved in fossil fuels and all these other things. And once they're locked inside, no surprise, one of the students ends up dropping dead, and they're locked in the house and someone is a killer, and they have to try to figure out who it is and how to get out and all that kind of stuff. And they have to surrender their phones before they go in, of course, which is the worst thing you could do to a college student, is not lock them in the house, not make them take an exam or even murder them, but make them surrender their phone for 8 hours. That's the worst hardship they suffer.
Well, you know, this reminds me a little bit of Oxford. Colin Dexter, you know, was not actually a don at Oxford. He was a proctor. That because Oxford sits exams exactly the way you're talking about it. And SATs were really like that. I mean, you know, I took my SATs in 1957, but I can certainly remember that, you know, it was a very similar environment. We didn't even have phones then. So, you know, the question was, had you written anything, you know, on your cuff or your fingernail or whatever, but those exams were certainly proctored. I was thinking so much about, because when I went to Stanford in 1958, things were fairly calm. When I left after my graduate degree to go to another graduate degree at Northwestern, Berkeley was like insane, you know, in 62 and 63. I mean, I remember demonstrating against UAC in 1960 and being washed down the steps of the courthouse in San Francisco with fire hoses, and my father was furious with me. But you know what Berkeley was like in the, you know, early 60s with the Vietnam War. And it seems to me that we've come around to that again, but what we have are disparate causes more than we have, like, you know, everybody against the war. Now you've got people with like special interest group protests. It could be the climate deniers, or it could be this or that. Am I wrong on that? Is there enough cohesion that the protests tend to be inclusive?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a big unifying issue like the war. I mean, I was in college when the first Gulf War happened, and there were protests about that. So that seemed like a unifying thing. But yeah, generally, I mean, it seems like every group would have their own protest. But in this book, it is a protest against this family because they founded the money. You find out some secrets about the founder of the college, who's been dead for 150 years, and his statue greets you as you go into the grounds of the college. But some secrets come out about him and his behavior in the Civil War, and in addition to what his company has been doing over the years. So those are all things that tend to get today's college students fired up to go out and protest.
You might have enjoyed, you could still enjoy it because it's up on our Facebook and YouTube pages. We did an event Monday night with Professor Richard White from Stanford, now Professor Emeritus, and probably he wouldn't have written this book until he was securely an emeritus. But basically, the title of the book is Who Killed Jane Stanford? And he makes the case, I mean, there were rumors about it when I was an undergraduate, that Mrs. Stanford, who when her husband died, had the funding that created Stanford University, was about to destroy it. She, you know, she did all kinds of turns. She didn't want women there. She got, you know, hyper worried about male students being distracted by sexuality. I mean, we had rules when I was there. We had a 10 o'clock curfew. We had to wear dresses on campus. I mean, this was 1958. She'd been dead for a long time. But anyway, the thesis of the book is that it was in the interests of the university, the early administrators and so forth, to kill her before she destroyed the university. And he actually proves his case. which I find completely fascinating. So I got a group of Stanford alumni authors like me together, and we did this event. And so I found that your discussion of, you know, Hyde and the funding and on all of that reminded me very much of how people get, you know, acquire an interest in keeping an institution going. And if it's in the control of some one or two people with all the money, you know, then that person can actually become a target, can become a real problem. And so I found your scenario completely believable.
Yeah, without giving too much away, that question does come up in the book of whether the college administrator is the one who wants to knock the donor off, because the current person who controls the Hyde fortune is unreliable. He's got a little bit of a drinking problem. He's kind of a loose cannon. So maybe the university wants him to go away and pass it on to the next member of the family.
Absolutely. Organizational maintenance is a very powerful, well, it is, you know, I mean, in companies, universities, whatever. I mean, I was really proud of Richard White for actually writing the book, because I think it's been something that people have wondered about for such a long time. Fascinating. So Joshua, one of the things I thought was really interesting about your book is that your guy is dealing with grief. He has lost his husband, and he's come back to Sandy Lake, this little town, in an effort to kind of survive, but he's not even firing on all cylinders because he's so swamped with grief for his husband. I used to say partner, but now I should say husband. Is that right?
Yeah, they weren't actually married, and they were still trying to figure out their relationship. So he was dating another police officer in the Twin Cities. They were both cops, and they've been together for about a year, and were still kind of figuring out what exactly it was that they were doing when this other man was killed on the job. And so after he dies, Packard realizes that he finds out that he's this guy's beneficiary and for all of his insurance stuff and his estate, and to Packard, he was still figuring out what the relationship meant to him at the time when he was killed. And so he feels terrible that maybe they weren't on the same level when this guy was still alive and they hadn't talked about it. And so, but he is very much dealing with grief, and it's really affecting his job and his happiness in the city. And rather than kind of confronting these things head on, he heads up north to this small town where he grew up. He has a family connection. That family used to have a cabin in this small town. And I think I mentioned in the book that he takes the geography cure, like they talk about in the recovery circles. All my problems will be different, or I can leave them all behind if I just pick up, move, and start over somewhere else. And he finds out that doesn't actually work that way.
Well, that's true. But the flaw in his thinking here is that he isn't starting over in an unknown place. He's actually gone back to a place, you know, so he's compounded his problem in a way rather than escaped it, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. He's drawn to this place because of the history. It reminds him of better times in his life, but it also has, it's also another source of grief, because when he was a child, he had an older brother who disappeared during the family holiday in this small town. He was presumed to be drowned in a snowmobile accident on a lake, but the body was never recovered. And so he's also got, not only is he dealing with the grief from his relationship, but coming back to this small town kind of picks the scab off of that terrible time that happened with his family. And he's kind of in a position to look into it now, even though that's really not the focus of this book.
Okay, guys. Well, I've asked my major questions, so why don't I sit back? And David, why don't you talk to Joshua, and, you know, he can talk to you, and we'll see where we go.
Well, the thing that I really enjoyed about the book was the complexity of the characters. I thought that as I read the book and I'm thinking about it as a writer, I'm thinking, okay, how are you going to pull off that you have this guy in the cabin who's committed these crimes in the past. You have these kids who are breaking into the cabin to steal drugs. You have this main character, the cop, who has these issues from his past, right? And so somehow you manage to give all these characters this complexity, and yet we understand and can relate to all the characters. That, to me, that was the thing, and I'm just wondering how you approached giving all these characters, even characters who were doing things that were not necessarily that ethical or wonderful, we understood them and related to them in some way. That was the thing that stuck out to me.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, this isn't a whodunit. You know, you know from the beginning where the kids are, you know who's got them. And so, and the point of view kind of alternates between Emmett, who's got this girl in his basement, and Packard, who's looking for her. So it's really, it's not so much a whodunit as it is watching Packard go through the motions and try to ask the right questions and put the dots together. So it's a pretty character driven story, in that I felt like I needed strong characters that people could engage with and who could drive the story, since it's not so much a classic whodunit where I keep reading to find out what happened, or keep reading to find out where the girl is or who the bad guy is, because we already know all those things.
Well, that too is an interesting choice, right? Because I think sometimes we think, like, let's hide as much information as possible until the end of the book. In a way, you're doing the exact opposite. You're saying, here's the big question you would normally read for, right? But then it becomes almost a, you know, why did they do it? And are they going to find it out? You know, when are the lines going to converge, and what's going to happen then?
Yeah.
Now, Joshua, your turn. What would you like to ask David?
So David, one of the things I thought that was interesting about the finalists, and I don't know if I'm on track here or not, but it seemed like a clever take on a lot of the genre tropes. This book is a little bit Manor House mystery. It's a little bit Locked Room. It's a little bit, you know, Remote Island, where everybody's in one place and can't leave, and they're being picked off one at a time. It's Dark Academia. Were you kind of trying to play with those ideas as you were writing this, or did it just kind of come off that way?
Well, it makes me sound really smart to think that I was doing all those things consciously, but I don't think I was. No, what happened is, so, like, you know, like Barbara said, I'm a college professor. I had not really written a book set on a college campus until my last book, Kill All Your Darlings, which was set on a college campus. And then when it was time to come up with an idea for the next book, my editor said, have you ever thought about trying a locked room story? And I don't really know why she said that, unless it was, it's kind of been a trend lately. People have done it. I don't know if she was trying to push me in some different direction. This is my 14th book. So it's like you start to run out of reasons why people are killing people and places to kill people and methods to kill people. So maybe she was saying, like, try the locked room. And I said, and I thought about it, and I said to her, well, what if we did locked room with academia? And the answer was yes. So that's how that all started. And then after that, I just really drew on a couple of big experiences in my life. My previous teaching job was at a little tiny private college in North Carolina called St. Andrews. It was then called St. Andrews Presbyterian College. It's now called St. Andrews College. But it was a little tiny private college in the middle of nowhere in North Carolina, with like 800 students, and the school was always having financial trouble. And so I understood, being at that school, what it was like to try to get donors to give money for something, to try to get students to stick around to pay tuition. because you weren't getting subsidies from the state or anything like that. So I had that whole experience of being at this isolated little college where it was just full of eccentrics and donors who were eccentrics. And every once in a while you'd get dragged along to like, hey, this Sunday we're gonna go to see this donor and, you know, you better be on your best behavior and, you know, get out, you know. So it was that whole experience from the administrator side. And then the students, the six students who are locked in the house all have this intense financial need. And we all know that college debt is a big issue and people coming out of college with lots of debt. And even though I graduated from college 1,000 years ago, I had college debt when I finished college that took me years to pay off. I did pay it off, but it took me years to pay off. And so if someone had come to me when I was 21 years old and said, if you can have your college debt potentially eliminated if you just get locked in this creepy house with this weird, creepy guy on a Saturday afternoon and take a test, I would have said, yes, please sign me up for that. So I felt like I could see it from both sides, the side of the administrator, the faculty member, and then the side of the students. The only person I can't really see it from is the rich donor, because I can't donate that much money to a college.
It's really interesting how the, it's almost like a game that's being played here. And there's very high stakes for these people, for the students that are involved in this, in the decisions that they make that are not in their best interest or actually go against their practical safety because they are so desperate for this scholarship. I thought it was really a great premise and I thought you handled it really well.
I had no idea if I could write a locked room story, but the hard part is like, how do you keep people in the house? You know, you gotta get the phones out of their hands and you've gotta like keep them in the house. You know, you've got to give them a compelling reason to stay in the house. Assuming like you said, there's the whole, like you could send them off to an island somewhere or whatever. But if they're kind of in civilization, how do you keep people in the house? Right. You know, so that was kind of the thing. I guess this is the thing that always comes up with me because I've never written a series and all of my books have been standalones. And so people always say, are you ever going to write a series? Why don't you write a series? And they, and then people will say to me, well, what's the difference between a series and standalones? And I feel unqualified to answer that question since I've never written a series. But here you are. Your first book is clearly intended to be a series. I'm just wondering, like, was that, because I always feel a little intimidated by the idea of the series, like, can you find enough for this character to do and enough for this character to change? Like, what if, you know, what if this becomes like 30 years from now, you're still writing about this guy? What's going to happen to him over 30 years? That's what would scare me, right? How did you approach that?
Yeah, I have to be honest and say I haven't really looked 30 years out at this point. They asked me, you know, when I met with the folks at Sourcebooks and Poison Pen Press, they really liked the character of Ben Packard and they were asking me, did I want to write more than one book with this guy? And I said, yes, I think I could write several books with him. And there's some unresolved book stuff from the first book. And, you know, I know what's gonna happen in the first three books. And I think I can write a lot more than that. We were talking about William Kent Kruger and he's had a series for, I don't know how long he's been writing Cork O'Connor books, 20 plus years now, probably.
More than that.
More than 20, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a similar situation. Cork O'Connor was the sheriff at one time, and I haven't read all of them. The most recent one I read was Lightning Strike, which is a prequel to the Cork O'Connor series. But he's been pulling it off for a long time, and I think I have a lot to learn and can learn from reading the rest of William Kent Kruger's books. But it's a good question, like how do you write a series in a small town and not murder the whole entire population by the 10th book? It would be like Cabot Cove with Angela Lansbury and Murder, She Wrote, where the new people show up for every episode and they're the ones that are going to get killed 10 minutes in. But yeah, it's something to think about. I can't say that I thought all the way that far out in the future, but I like this character. I know I can write several books about him, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Well, you just gave one idea, which is you can go back and do the prequels to when he was in Twin Cities, right? And you can get into that whole relationship. So you've got some rich backstory that you can go back and write about. It's smart to give the character this issue from the past, right? Because then you can go back and you've got something, you know, if he was like 18 years old and had never been anywhere, what would you do? But, you know, you've got like a history you can write about.
Yep.
So David, there's actually a way to think about this. I've had this discussion, Riley Sager and I talked about this Tuesday when we had him at the store. People who write standalones like world building, they like, you know, it's not that different than science fiction writers, because every book you write, you basically have to create a world, right? You have to decide where it's going to be and who the characters are and all the rest of it. People who write series are really writing, it's character building more than world building. They did the world building or the basic thing in the first book. And so what they're doing is that they are moving characters forward in different ways. And so it's not even, I mean, they are sort of the same skill set. You shouldn't be intimidated by the idea of writing two or three stories about a character any more than Josh should be thinking, you know, maybe I'll write three about his guy and then write something completely different. That's what Michael Connelly did. I had many conversations with him because, you know, we did his first ever event, and apparently he says we're going to do his last whenever that comes. So I've been with Michael forever, just like William King Krueger. And both of them have talked to me about the fact that at some point a story came to them that didn't fit the characters they'd created, but they really liked the story. So with Michael, it was the poet. If you remember, he wrote four books about Harry. And then Harry came to the end of a cycle when he was investigating the death of his mother. That was the story arc of the first four books. And then he went off and he wrote the poet and he came back. So Kent has written Cork O'Connor's like decimating his family and his, you know, why he's been really cruel to that. But he also has written a couple of standalones that have done really well, which would never have been Cork O'Connor stories. So, you know, it's possible to do both. You have to like a character enough to want to continue him, I think is the issue. You have to give a lot of thought to the character instead of a lot of thought to the world that you're building. I mean, that may sound simplistic, but that's really how I look at it.
Yeah, and I really like reading long series and even TV shows where something that was introduced early on that I've kind of forgotten about, but you know, later on you see the author or the TV show go back to it, and I think like, oh yeah, that guy was in the second season, that guy was in the third book, and you know, it always looks like the person has a great plan for it. I don't know if they do, but it makes the world feel really big and rich, because life is like that, right? We go years without seeing people, and then you cross paths with someone again and you're like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot that person existed, but here they are, and you can reintroduce them and do something. So yeah.
Well, you are stuck with basic characteristics that you gave your character. I mean, you know, if your character is a 6 foot like Reacher, you can't suddenly shrink him down to, you know, and give him a case of dwarfism or something. I mean, you can't, you know, that's not going to work out, but you can plant, you know, things that you don't pursue and then leave them to develop over time. Karen Slaughter's interesting in that she does all this stuff. You know, she'll write maybe two books about a character, or she'll write a whole series about a character, and then she'll write standalones. I mean, it's interesting how her mind works if you look over the whole course of her work. And, you know, I don't think there are any right way or wrong way to do any of this. I think it's whatever excite you. I'd like you to talk to Josh about his path to getting published, because it was a somewhat tortuous one, according to the literature that I've been provided.
Okay, well, I mean, are there non-torturous paths to getting published? Because I'd like to hear, that's the more interesting story.
Yeah, that would be a unique one.
uh, But no, I am curious how this debut came about then, because it seems like it's a character you've thought about for a while. So yeah, how did this come about?
Yeah, so Inari Kepter is actually the third novel that I've written. I've got two trunk novels that I spent a long time writing, really just learning how to write a novel. And the book I wrote before Inari Kepter was also set in this town of Sandy Lake. And it had a scene where there's a small plane crash, and people who witnessed the plane crash are being interviewed by the sheriff's deputy. And later the main character, and he's telling his friend about being interviewed by the sheriff's deputy, and they have a conversation about him being gay, pretty crude terms. And then the rest of the novel goes on. The sheriff's deputy had no role in the story. I have no idea why he was gay, except for to be the butt of this joke that this conversation that they're having. So I sent that book out to agents, and four or five of them read the whole thing, and they all said, it's good, but it's got major problems. And at that point, I was done with that book. I didn't know how to figure out how to fix the problems of it. And but I kept thinking about this deputy, and I kept thinking about what would it be like to be a gay cop in a small rural town. And I kind of liked the setting that I'd come up with. So I plucked him out of that book, and I just wrote a whole nother book with him as the main character to figure out what his life was like, where he came from, what his secrets were. One of the agents who read the second book, who passed on it, said, I want to see what you write next. So I came back to her several years later and showed it to her, and she signed me up. I thought the hard work was done getting an agent. I was like, all right, I got an agent. Let's print it, pack, and ship it. We're moving on to the next thing. I didn't realize how torturous the submission process was. Then once she does her job and goes from publishing house to publishing house and editor to editor, and they tell you how much they love your book, but all the things that they would like to see differently. And then you spend 3 months rewriting it, and then they just walk away. And then you move on to the next publishing house and the next editor, and you spend 3 months rewriting your book to their exact specifications. And then you hear it's a pass. So that happened several times. And then Sourcebooks came along, Poison Pen Press. And at that point, and I think those revisions helped. I mean, it really helped me tighten up the book. And there were some things that I added in the later revisions that I'm really happy about, and actually are some of the seeds that will go into the later books. So third time was the charm. But yeah, it was a long process, painful, exhausting, heartbreaking. But when you finally get the call and get the contract, it was amazing.
Was this book on submission given when it was published? Was this on submission like pandemic time too? Was that?
Oh, I'm trying to remember.
Things were moving so slow then too, you know?
Yeah.
Probably maybe part of it.
It took a year and a half for the book to come out. So I think we signed the contract. We were in the pandemic when I signed the contract, and then it was another year and a half until the book came out.
Yeah. But that thing you just said about, that's kind of like the series, right? The little minor throwaway scene from the one book became the main character of the next book, right? But
yep.
The same locale. Yep. Yeah, interesting.
So as the professor of creative writing, David, you know, what would you have done with a student like Joshua? Because he obviously was doing this on his own.
You mean, what would I have told him? I would have said that sounds strangely non-torturous just to have written two books that didn't get published, you know. I just always tell my students that I think sometimes with everything in our culture, there's an emphasis on talent, and maybe it comes from sports. Sports are so prominent, and we always think like great athletes are just so talented, and they are, but they're also usually really hardworking and persistent and determined and competitive and all that. And in a way, I think writing is the same thing. It's not necessarily just like, do you have this natural, you either have this talent or you don't have this talent. It's more just the persistence, right? Like writing the third book after the first two were rejected, a lot of people, you know, send the one thing out and it gets rejected and they're like, well, that's it. I wasn't destined to be a writer. I don't have anything to say. I think that people who persist, right, and the fact that listening to what the editors said, even editors who passed on the book or agents who passed on the book, sometimes there are helpful comments there. Sometimes those things make the book better. So I just think that's what I would say is the persistence and the endurance. That's usually the more important characteristic.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I was an English major in college a long time ago. I started to get an MFA in the mid 90s, I think it was. I didn't finish. I always knew I wanted to write. I always knew I was going to be a writer, but the writing had a different priority at different points in my life. And then if I finally got to the point where it's like, am I going to do this or not? And then I didn't know how to write a novel, but I had an idea. So I think a lot of it, like you said, is persistence and just doing the work and not giving up. And, you know, I started writing my first novel, it was probably 17 years ago. So 17 years is a long time to keep after something with not much to show for it.
Did you think about, you know, enrolling in a writing course, a creative writing or an MFA or even a writer's group or going to a writer's conference?
Yeah, so I got like half of my MFA and I just wasn't getting what I wanted out of the program. It was costing, I was taking out a lot of student loans. I was teaching and all my time was spent preparing for class and grading papers and meeting with students and very little time writing in this MFA program. After I dropped out and moved back to the Twin Cities, I took some classes at The Loft, which is a really fantastic writing organization here in Minneapolis, and met a woman, Mary Gardner, who kind of became a friend and a mentor. And so, yeah, I took some classes at The Loft, and I think classes are great for meeting other writers and finding writing community. I think it's hard to teach people how to write a novel. I think, I don't know, David, you probably have a different opinion, but I don't know that any class taught me how to write a novel. I learned how to write a novel by reading a lot and by trying to write novels.
Yeah, I think that graduate school is useful in that you can be in a community of writers and you have deadlines, because out in the real world, and I tell my students this, out in the real world, if you're not in school, I mean, nobody gives a crap if you're writing your story or not. No one's coming along and checking on you. No one's saying like, yep, hey, are you pursuing your dream today? You know, no one says that to you. I mean, you might have a partner, a spouse, a good friend who does it, but most people don't really care that much about what you're doing. So I think that the classes and the graduate program can give someone a community. I don't think it's a magic bullet to getting somewhere, yep, right? And most, whether it's an undergraduate or a graduate program, they're not really set up to teach. It's a weird thing. They're not really set up to teach people to write novels, because you can't write a novel in a semester.
Right.
But most people want to write novels. There's not a great short story market. You're kind of destined to write novels if you want to try to make a living as a writer. So it's a strange thing that, you know, people might write short stories in school and then you have to write a novel somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
Or poetry. I have been an instructor in many a writing group or, you know, writing conference or some such thing. I've always found poets to be the most difficult. They don't want anybody to touch a single word they've written, but yet they're there, you know, with the idea. And I feel like, you know, they didn't come for critique, they came for applause, which is really kind of self-defeating, but I agree. I mean, I've done pitch fest, all kinds of things. Here's the thing, you know, I read for voice, and it's an almost impossible thing to teach anybody because we all perceive voice differently. You know, I talk about this all the time at events we've done. I've hosted, as you know, thousands of events and edited over 800 books and so forth. And the common denominator always for me is, am I engaged enough with this voice to want to spend time with it? Or am I so bored or so put off, you know, for whatever reason? But, you know, that's true in daily life. We all meet people. Yeah, some of them, you know, wow, this is going to be a friend for life. And others we go, I want to get out of the room before, you know, I'm gonna, whatever. And I think it works the same way. And that's why it's very hard to teach anybody how to write a voice. You have to develop your own. Yeah. And you have to realize that not everybody's going to love your voice. So you have to pursue it to the point where you find, as you did, Joshua, an editor who likes your voice enough, you know, to so and sometimes it's just luck, you know, that you finally find that person. You know, it's a very fine line hosting author events, I have to say. I made a rule years and years ago when there was another mystery bookstore that invited a well-known author to the store and then trashed the book before they got there because they decided they didn't like it. I thought that is so unbelievably not just rude, but unkind and also stupid. You know, and so yeah. I decided, regardless of whether I like the book or not, I am never going to have that kind of public response to it. And, you know, there's a big difference. People who shopped with us for years, there's a big difference between my selling a book and letting a book sell itself. And, you know, people who are used to shopping with us can tell the difference. And so we, you know, we're always polite and enthusiastic or, you know, kind anyway to all the authors that come to see us, even if sometimes we don't really feel that way. But it's just, you know, good manners and so forth. I think editors can't afford that. Editors have to put their money on the line, whatever budget they've got, and invest in a voice where they really are committed. They're not just going to let a book sell itself. Doesn't work that way. So, you know, I think that David's right, Joshua, the persistence and faith in yourself, you know, is the only way to go forward, that you have to hope eventually you're going to find that match.
Right. Yep. I agree. And I think that, as you also said, the writing community is super important too. It's really lonely work and isolating work being a writer and a novelist, and I have a fantastic writing group that I'm part of, and we meet regularly and read each other's works and cheer each other on and knock each other down when we need to and build each other up. And having that honest feedback about your work and what's working and what's not is a really invaluable part of the process, I think.
So neither you have a, David, I haven't asked you what you're working on. Joshua has already told us what he's working on next, but what are you working on?
Well, I have my first young adult suspense novel is coming out in the fall with Source Books.
Yep.
She's gone. Isn't it funny? I just happened to have a copy of the other copy here. It just randomly was here. But this is my first young adult suspense novel, and that's coming out on November 1st. So that's basically finished. And then next year, I've turned in the first version of my adult novel for Berkeley, which will be out next summer, and I'm working on the second young adult suspense novel right now.
So how do you define young adult as compared to adult? What are you doing that's different? I noticed that you had written one, and that's why I wanted to ask you about this.
The main thing for me is that the main character, the protagonist, has to be a teenager. So the main character in this book is a high school senior. His girlfriend has disappeared. He and his girlfriend were in a car accident on the night of their homecoming dance. And he, the main character, Hunter, wakes up in the hospital and he is told that they were in this accident. He has no memory of the accident and he has no memory of the dance. And he's told that his girlfriend, Chloe, has disappeared without a trace from the scene of the accident. She was in the car. There's a little bit of her blood in the car, but there's no sign of her. And naturally, he becomes the prime suspect in her disappearance, and he has to try to prove what happened. So it's that he's the protagonist, and he's a 17-year-old. And, you know, you have to think about getting, it's a first-person narration, so you have to think about getting, I mean, it's not that I'm engaging with a lot of, like, teenage slang, but, you know, you have to make it the voice and the sensibility of a 17-year-old. I had to age it up for me because I have the sensibility of an 11-year-old. So I had to go up a little bit from where I actually am inside. But that's basically the idea.
So are there, you know, restrictions? Are there language restrictions or any guidelines that you have to meet if you're writing for a young adult world?
You know, young adult deals pretty frankly with sex and drugs and all the things that kids encounter when they're in high school. I mean, my book is not like super graphic, but it's frank about the fact that these are two 17-year-olds in a relationship, and 17-year-olds like to do certain things when they're in a relationship. So all those things are happening, and cursing and all that stuff is there. So it's not really anything that, there aren't really huge descriptions. I mean, I would imagine most young adult books aren't graphically violent, but most mainstream books aren't that graphically violent anyway.
So is it really the protagonist, the age of the protagonist, and the interest that makes it young adult fiction rather than adult fiction?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I mean, I think that since it's like when we were growing up, there were books like Catcher in the Rye and Lord of the Flies that clearly, if they came along today, they would be young adult. But when they were just books, or by the time I was reading them in school, they transcended to being literature. But, you know, those are young adult books.
That's really interesting. I've often wondered at the distinction. There are a lot of writers who that I know of who have written. Jim Rollins has written young adult books, you know, and I always wonder what the difference is. But I guess I hadn't really thought about it would largely be the character of the leading character, who that person is and what age they are, what interest they are, that would determine that. About that. So Patrick, you're the English major in this crew, along with the come up and join us. And do you have any questions or comments you want to make yourself?
Well, let me get to some of these questions from the audience online here.
Okay.
I like to say I'm a recovering English major, yes. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Okay, so Vicky would like to know, what is the most, for both of you, what is the most challenging part of your writing process?
I think it's just, it's coming up with the original idea every year, you know, of the thing, because with my editor every year, I would say like, well, what if we have a book where so-and-so does this? And then someone would come along and say, well, you know, you killed somebody with a shoe 3 books ago, so you can't do that again, right? That's always the thing, is finding the original setting, idea, concept.
Yeah, for me, I think with this series, the idea for, you know, kind of the major crime or the main plot of this book came fairly easy. It was a lot of work building up that the character of Ben Packard and figuring out his backstory and planting some of that. The main crime for the second book, I had the idea for that, and that turned out to be fairly, it was a different book to write. But I think it's figuring out, like David said, it's figuring out the plot and figuring out the main crime for each new book is probably going to be the hardest part going forward.
Packard's a great old school name too. How did you come up with that? It evokes, it creates a, just the name itself evokes an earlier era to me anyway.
You know, I was thinking about a lot of these series characters and the names that they have, and they're short and punchy. They're Jack Reacher and Harry Bosch, and I think Lucas Davenport probably has a lot of more syllables than the average one. He had a number of names as I was writing the book, and there's this play on his name that I was thinking about. I was already thinking to the second book, and I didn't want his last name to be Packer, but it Packard sounded close enough. And then his first name kept changing. It was John, it was Jim, it was different things. And at the very end, I changed it to Ben Packard. And that had kind of the shortness and the punchiness to it that I wanted.
Let's see here. Mandy, you're talking about the audience for a gay detective. Mandy says, the internet nearly broke when My Policeman starring Harry Styles was announced. The audience for a gay detective is definitely here for it. And then somebody else mentioned that Anne Cleves has started something, a new series, is that right?
Yes, and he is a gay detective. It's the one that is set down in Devon, I think it is. It's her third series, and actually they're turning it into television. Two books. One of them's already been on TV. I think they're very good.
Let's
I'll have to look that up.
You and I talked to Rosalie Connect last night, and her Vera Kelly is in fact, gay. And one of the things we talked about, Joshua, was whether in today's hyper environment you can write a gay series if you're not gay. So she has written a trilogy, and she's quietly leaving it there because she's not.
Interesting.
And I think that was comes back to what I was talking to David about, earlier on, is that, we have all these little special interest or pressure or whatever it is, groups, and nobody wants to incite a Twitter mob or, get called out for something. But, I think the point of fiction is the author's imagination. I hate the idea that writers are going to end up being siloed according to who they actually are.
Yeah.
I'm really opposed to that.
Yeah. And I don't want to claim that I'm the first author with a series main character who's gay. Ellen Hart has been writing Jane Lawless books for 30 years. And
right.
Joseph Hansen, I believe, wrote a series that started in the 70s.
He did. And Michael Nava was absolutely my favorite. Michael Nava is just a fabulous author. And I saw that he'd recently come back and written something after quite a long hiatus. But yeah, Joseph Hansen, you're absolutely right. And then, of course, we have Patricia Highsmith, but she wasn't really out. Patrick is a Patricia Highsmith,
She was pretty out.
Well, but in her books, was she? I mean, as a person, yes, but are the books particularly that way? I haven't read them for so long, I can't remember.
It depends upon when, what era in history they're talking about. A lot of it was about, this forbidden obsession.
Right. And Nicola Upson is writing a series about where Josephine Tay is, in fact, gay and living with an actress. And those books are doing very well. She's a UK author that has done mm-hmm. well. So we're seeing a lot more of it. And this is Gay Pride Month. So we're seeing, in fact, a lot of attention being paid to characters across the spectrum. Actually, Sourcebooks has in its possession a book I acquired and edited by Douglas Burgess, which is about a transgender detective, which I think is one of the best books I ever published. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I don't know if they're ever going to do anything with it or not. It really annoys me that it's been, kind of, I hope somebody in Sourcebooks is listening. Really, because we sold the press to Sourcebooks a while back, but I've always thought that was one of the very best books that Rob and I ever acquired, and I loved working on it. He's just an incredibly talented guy, but I thought everything about it, it even had pirates. I mean, God, it had the whole thing. It was just amazing. I'll try to remember the title. I'll look it up, Patrick, while you ask another question.
It had fog in it, right? Something fog.
Yeah.
I'll check with my connections and see what I can find out.
Push for it.
Let's see here. Yeah, one of the people watching says, I want to read that book. So let's
You do, absolutely. Yeah.
You sold us on it, Barbara.
It had a terrible cover. I have to say that the author had a friend. One of the things that really hurt it was that he had a friend who had done a cover design that he really liked, and in a moment of madness we agreed to let him use that, and it was a kiss of death.
Let's see here. Well, David, you've already talked about this a little bit, but that you've done standalones thus far, any plans to try a series, or does that just not really interest you that much?
It would interest me. Actually, the book that I have just turned into Berkeley for next year, which is right now called Try Not to Breathe. I don't know what the title's going to end up being. But the main character in that book is a former police officer who's been off the police force for a few years. And part of her journey through the book is kind of coming, she's looking for her sister who's gone missing, kind of coming around at the end of the book to saying, maybe I want to be back in police work. So there's the door is a little open to that. So you never know. Maybe this conversation tonight will send me headlong into a series and we'll go from there.
Another interesting writer, one of my favorites is T. Jefferson Parker. And, you know, he's gone back and done kind of a bit of both. You know, he's done these small groupings, small series, and then moves on to something else. Yeah,
let's see. I found it. It's called Fogland Point by Douglas Fogland Burgess. Point. Fogland Point. Point. I'm telling you, it is amazing. And I'd really always wanted him. He had more to explore. But honestly, you both should get a copy. And if you can't find one, I'm sure I have a manuscript around somewhere. Just
super. We'll have to tag him on this discussion when it's over. Probably cheer him up.
Yeah.
Let's see, Molly, it's going back to what you were talking about with MFA programs, both of you really. She says, so glad you're saying this, Joshua, about how classes, especially grad programs in creative writing, don't really help you learn to write a novel. Maybe that's debatable. I feel like the MFA is held up as something writers must do before they make it. But so many great writers never got a graduate degree. Amen. You know?
Yeah.
Both ways of looking at that.
I think there's a lot to learn in an MFA program. Like David said, you're not going to write a novel in a semester, and they're not going to teach you how to write a novel or watch over your shoulder as you try to write a novel. There's a lot to learn about characterization and you know, all the mechanics of writing a good story and what makes a good story a good story. But an MFA is not required to write a book. I finally kind of realized that. I like, this is costing me a lot of money and I'm not really doing the writing that I want to do. And I think I can do it on my own. It might take me longer to figure it out, but that's the path I followed.
It's good to see that. Maybe I'm right, that, or maybe I'm wrong rather, that creative writing departments and universities are more receptive to genre fiction now. It seemed like for a long time, part of the gripe about MFA was that, you know, you were taught how to write the quote, well-made story, you know, the angst of the white Ivy League, you know, professor guy, you know, that style of story, the Richard Ford kind of. When I was going, it was all, everybody was writing Raymond Carver knockoffs, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s kind of thing. And, but not just the creative writing programs, but I understand that even the literary classes are starting to, you know, bring some classics of crime fiction into the canon. Is that true, or is that wishful thinking?
I think that is starting to change. I think that if you talk to today's students, they don't make those strict distinctions between literature and genre. I think they just consume things. They just read and watch movies and whatever, and they don't get too hung up on that. You know, there are some uptight people in the academy who still make those distinctions, but I do think the ice is starting to melt a little bit on that.
That's great.
Which is good. I agree with you. It's good.
Right. Let's see. Anybody else here? Joshua, about you, the kind of the cast and characters that you populate your small town with. Can you dig a little bit into that a little bit more? Are they based on people that you know, or there's some composites? Trying to find the actual question. Sandy Lake's residents are an interesting group. Did you draw on people you've met before when populating the town?
No, I can't say that I did. I have, you know, I grew up in a small town, spending the summers with my dad in a small town in South Dakota. I went to a small college in a small town. We have a cabin in a small town in Wisconsin. So, you know, Sandy Lake is kind of an amalgam of all those places. And it would actually be hard for me to point out where it actually is on a map in Minnesota. It's north a little bit. But no, none of those characters are based on anyone in real life. It was just a matter of imagining the people who live there, what they do for a living, what their family life is like. But yeah, it's 100% fiction.
So one could ask David whether the students in his book, The Finalists, are based on any students that he actually has taught.
Just the ones I wanted to kill after having.
Right.
No, I, it's, It's pieces of lots of things and then imagination. I mean, you know, it is, you can't just, I think some people are so strange in real life that if you put them in a book, people would say, this is unbelievable. So you kind of have to make people a little more real in a book than some people are in real life.
That's an excellent point. You know, we've talked so much about the fact that if you were trying to plot a book on things going around us in the world today, that nobody would believe it because, you know, the actual things are far beyond what anybody would find believable in fiction. So on that note, we probably wind this up. I did want to make an addendum to Douglas Burgess. I see now that Sourcebooks republished Fogland Point as Dark Currents, C-U-R-R-E-N-T-S. So if you're looking for it, that's the title that you want to do. And I'm happy to have any feedback from anybody, but I'm serious. I thought it was one of the best books I've ever edited. I absolutely loved it. The pirates are fabulous. And Doug Burgess is actually a world authority on pirates because he's a professor of law at Yeshiva University, and pirates are his specialty. So there we are. It's so great. Anyway, guys, what a pleasure it is to spend time with you. It was a great pleasure to meet you, Joshua. And David, I always love being with you. So thanks so much. David's publication date is not until July 5th. So those of you who are looking to grab a copy of his book will be frustrated until then. The finalists.
They can pre-order one from Poison Pen, though, right now, right?
You can. And actually, we're going to send you some to autograph. So
yes.
That. And Joshua's book, And There He Kept Her, is out right now, as far as I know, right?
Yep. Came out on the 14th.
The 14th. So we're a little bit late with that one. Anyway, two wonderful books to think about for 4th of July weekend, when some of us might spend the weekend reading if we're not out, you know, boating or firecracking or whatever. Do you know they've canceled almost all the fireworks in Phoenix, I read today, because the supply chain issues, which have made publishing such a disaster, have affected the fire. The fireworks industry is not able to supply fireworks. So I'm telling you.
Be a lot of happy dogs.
I know. That's true. It's a very strange world.
There is never a shortage in Kentucky. There's never a shortage in Kentucky. You can always get your fireworks in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah? Well,
priority straight,
maybe we'll send a runner to Kentucky. I love the idea. Anyway, good night, everybody. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye, David.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.